Station number 14983, Albert Shippen, Rail 7.
Mr. A. Shippen, Rail 7. We've talked about a certain amount about defaulters, Mr. Shippen. Can you take me through the kinds of punishments that people were getting and how they were dealt with in the guardroom?
Yes, well, we've got two categories there. First of all, we've got the defaulter. Well, the defaulter was a chap who got extra punishment for committing minor misdemeanors. Probably late on parade, dirty buttons, his bed not made out correctly, being idle on parade, a few minutes absent. These people also had to carry out the military training, but it was a very exacting punishment because they had to parade first thing in the morning at the guardroom to see that they were in barracks, and then at lunchtime when everybody else was having a bit of relaxation, they had a report at the guardroom, and then in the evening there was a defaulter parade, and that's where they were given tasks, menial tasks, such as digging the garden, working in the cookhouse, assisting in the canteen, working in the officer's mess or the sergeant's mess. And they also had to be ready to carry out any of the training or carry out any of the duties that they were given. The duties that were given at that time, they could have been what they call a picket patrol, which they patrolled the camp with pick elves and everything like that. And then they had the emergency picket, which was where you slept partly clothed and had ammunition and also equipment to move by transport. And then there was the picket, which was there, and they slept fully clothed with equipment, ammunition and everything, and also had buses, which had no windows in, but was put into action straight away in case there was any parachute drops or any disturbances of any description. Now, when they came on the defaulters parade, not only did they have to parade and be present and answer the names as a defaulter, they also got inspected, which meant at all times they had very little leisure, and they got about half an hour in the evenings to go to the canteen, to purchase anything they required, and then, like everybody else, the lights went out at 10:15. So it was a very demanding punishment, really, for a chap who had committed a misdemeanor. Now, we go to the second category, and this is where men were put into the guardroom. Soldiers under sentence, SUS, as it was called. Now, these people had committed a crime between a misdemeanor and also a crime in military law, as well as civilian law. Remember, you had the two laws. They were governed by the civil code of law and also what was laid down by the military law. A lot of regiments, including the Durham Light Infantry, also had bylaws, and they were regimental rules which everybody had to adhere to because they were laid down by the regiment. Now, these people were probably absent for 2 or 3 days, and they were probably had lost equipment or they'd refused to be in order, and that was the category which the commanding officer had authority to deal with, giving a man up to 28 days detention. He had a permission then to give the man a 4-day remission. If you had this kind of punishment lashed out to you by the commanding officer, the next stage he could recommend was a summary of evidence, where 3 officers looked at all of the evidence for and against and recommended a court-martial. That went on to district, and then if it was severe crime, you then went on to the general field court martial, where you could end up in a civilian prison. Now, when you were incarcerated in the guard room, it was regimental punishment. Now, these personnel in the guard room, it was very harsh. First of all, they had no allowances, and neither did their families receive allowances, which was very hard on the family. Then they were out of bed, stood by the beds by reveille, which was up past six. The kit was laid out immaculate, and that was inspected. Then from there, they were taken to the ablutions and were issued with their razors to shave and carry out any ablution tasks that they thought was required.
They weren't allowed to keep a razor?
No. In fact, the next stage after that was when they returned to the cells, they were given the braces and the laces. They had no belts at all. Belts were issued when they were leaving the guard room to go on punishment.
Why was this?
Well, this was because every man was in solitary. There were individual cells, and of course, there was every half hour, people which were on the guard were had to go and observe through a peephole in the door to ensure that the man was not carrying out any self-inflicted wounds or hanging themselves or this kind of thing. Because, as I say, you've got to appreciate the fact that some of these people had never been disciplined before in their lives. And it was a tremendous shock to the system right the way through. After they'd done the ablutions and that, their next duty was to be paraded outside, and they were doubled off to the cook house to pick up their rations, and also the rations for the guard and the duty officer and that, the people that was night duty all the way through. Their containers were marked differently, and the food in the containers were differently. The soldiers under sentence got exactly the ration scale as laid down. And, of course, the remainder, the guard and that, were obviously got more rations because they'd been up all night and they were given the energy to carry out the duties of the following thing. After the breakfast meal, the soldiers under sentence then cleaned out all the dixies and containers and that came in. Then they went back to the cook house, and then they came back to the guard room, and the guard room was absolutely, positively scrubbed from one end to the other. Every plank, every board, every window was polished to perfection, every brass gong, clock, you name it, ablution area was cleaned, and that was the punishment that they did. I've even seen them clean out the guard room to perfection when the regimental police have turned around and said, well, that's not good enough, and thrown the bucket of dirty water over the area and told the men to clean it up again. Then, after that, they were put to tasks out in the garden under supervision by the regimental police, and they were kept fully occupied regardless of what the weather was, ensuring that the entrance to the barracks was in perfect order, military order. So the next thing that happened was, to the soldiers under sentence, they had the midday meal, and again they brought with them the guards' meals and everything out. After they had the midday meal, they went on punishment. They went out full field marching order, and they did tasks and doubled everywhere with their full field marching order on. They assisted in building the hockey pitch by hand, tools, and this is what. Then they came back, and once again, they went through the rigors of scrubbing out the guard room, polishing the great big black fire grate and that was in there, over and over again. Then they came for the evening meal. They had the evening meal, then they were locked up. You've got to remember that these men were not given any kind of luxury at all. They weren't allowed to smoke, they weren't allowed any chocolate. They got writing paper and an envelope to write a letter which was scrutinised and everything before it was dispatched. I can assure you that when they came out of there, they were clean and their hair was cropped and everything. You would tell someone who'd come out of detention very, very rapidly by just looking at the man's physique and his equipment, which was scrubbed lily white. And the brasses shone like a moonlit night.
Was there any experiences, to your knowledge, of striking them or digging them with sticks, anything of that nature, to stir them up?
No, I don't think that I can ever recall any physical punishment being lashed out. But, of course, it was in those days, I don't think we they realised the mental strain that was put onto these people. I think this mental strain of being doubled everywhere and shouted at and not given any respite at all was punishment enough. When you consider that these people, from half past 6 in the morning till, say, 7 o'clock at night retreat, they were given tasks over and over again, and they were never allowed any privacy whatsoever till they were locked up at 7 o'clock at night in the individual cells, and each went into self-reconfinement then, and the guards then, all they had was the guard opening these people and looking in to see that he was not committing any self-inflicted wound. So I think that was punishment enough for anybody. But shouting at them, yes. Physical tasks, yes. But not any brutality.
You didn't know anyone who attempted to do injury to themselves?
Well, I can't recall anyone, but I can recall that people having disturbances in the night and so forth, where fortunately for us, the medical centre was across the road and there was always a medical officer on duty, and 9 times out of 10 the SUS, the soldier under sentence, was taken to the medical centre under escort for the medical officer to see what damage or anything he'd done. But there was quite a number of the people, and let's face it, they were criminals in civilian life, and they're being called up, and they weren't going to change their ways regardless of what happened. So there was a progression from being a defaulter to being SUS, to being a summary of evidence, to being a court martial, and ending up in military prisons such as North Allerton, which was about Shepton Mallet, was another big one. And then, of course, if they received over 2 years for any great major crime they committed, they went to civilian prisons. One of the things that vividly I remember, though I never took part in it, was that every now and again, people probably carried out some misdemeanour to be in, put in prison in some form or other to avoid being sent overseas and going into action. But that idea was curtailed very, very rapidly, because every now and again they would go to these prisons with escort, and I'd give a set of man a set of handcuffs and handcuff a prisoner to a bloke who was going out on draft. They would then go with the draft to the port of embarkation and would be put on board the ship with the rest of the draft. And then that was it. They went off to wherever the draft was going, through the Middle East, the Far East, or wherever they were so-and-so. So they didn't sit it out. And if they wanted to run away, I suppose, when they were in the desert, well, they'd say, let them run away.
Where were the regimental police coming from?
Well, the majority of these people were ex, I would think, were ex-pre-war soldiers. And there were also a lot of policemen had been called up in the army. And I suppose that they took the majority of those people who had dealt with prisoners, both warders and policemen, and regimental policemen, pre-war and that, who had dealt with these kind of people, and they were the people that they were maintaining the regimental police force in the camps.
Were they particularly chosen for their toughness?
Well, I would think it's like everything else, that I recollected my years in the army, that the people who were incarcerated in the guardroom generally ended up on the regimental police and knew the ways of the criminal mind and therefore sorted it out. The provost sergeant was a chap called, I remember, called Harry Senior, Sergeant Harry Senior, and I was a bugler, and he frightened me to death. And these people had a way about them that when you looked at them, they had that air about them that they would sort you out come hell and high water.
We have mentioned the school and education from time to time, Mr. Shippen. Can you take me through what was happening to you, what kind of education you were getting in the army as a young boy?
Well, as a boy, we went to school 2 days a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, afternoons. We did the general educational studies because, being regulars, we had to obtain our education certificates of army standard. We did the usual arithmetic and went up or tried to obtain the standard of those days called the matriculation. We learned a tremendous lot about the British Empire, about the history of the British Army, and we also were indoctrinated by regimental history, which I suppose at the end of the day, when you consider that the majority of boys were going to become senior ranks in the army after the war, and that the traditions had become law, as the army say. We had a variety of educational subjects. You could apply to have a correspondence course, or there was libraries which you could borrow books from, and this was general education for anyone in the camp. From 6 o'clock onwards on the evening, there was lectures, and of course you could just imagine the number of people who had different occupations and being called up, and people carried on with their studies to and also to educate themselves, because a lot of the education had been interrupted by being called up. The officer who ran this unit was E.W. Short, and he later became an MP and also ended up in the House of Lords and was deputy leader of the Labour Party. He's still today very active in political ventures, and it was only about a couple of weeks ago he stood up in the House of Lords and was talking about the marbles that was brought in back from Greece, and he thought it was time that all the artifacts that was taken from different places while we had an empire should be dispatched back to them. I'm sure he got short shrift on that recommendation. He also, during this period of time, wrote the history of the Durham Light Infantry in aid of the Prisoner War Fund for the Durham Light Infantry. There was quite a variety of subjects you could take. There was science, there was general education, and also one of the things that they had there was discussion groups, which went down very well. I suppose to a lot of people, they weren't very popular to the majority of people, because these trainees had very little time to themselves, and it was only the dedicated educational people that did it. We, on joining the regiment, sat an educational test, which was about the standard of the third class certificate of education of the army, and therefore we automatically went to the standard of getting our second class. I think the majority, but not all, I think the majority of the boys got the second class certificate of education, even in the wartime educational program that the army was running. Another interesting thing that we were all indoctrinated in was called APCA. It was the Army Bureau of Current Affairs. One of the main topics that I can remember and is indelibly imprinted in my memory bank is the beverage plan. Obviously, Short, being a Labour-minded individual, a socialist, we got that hammered into us. I think we could recite more about the beverage plan than anybody else in Britain at that time. It later became the National Health. But that's the kind of subjects we were taking on education. He was a very good educational officer and was always interested in you taking on a subject or trying to enlighten you on what education would mean to you in the army in the future.
Many of the boys, of course, having left school, wouldn't carry on with any education, wouldn't they? With coming into the army, they were in a situation where they had to carry it on. So a number of the boys would achieve far more than they would have done educationally in the army than they would have done if they'd stayed at home.
Well, I think in that respect, and I later on in life, my civilian life, I would safely say without fear of contradiction that it did give me more confidence than I would have had if I'd left school and went to have an apprenticeship and that. I think it made me more worldly wide. Wise on the way that the army education went through it. I think that later on in life, because of the army training and the education I got, that it did stand me in good stead in my civilian life. I ended up a supply and purchasing officer for an international pump company, and I worked with people who were vastly better educated than I ever was, but because I had the ability to adapt and I could think a project through, and the job that I had, which was in charge of all purchase and stores, which was similar to a quartermaster in the army, I was able to carry on that employment to my employer's satisfaction.
Was Ted Short Army Education Corps or Durham Light Infantry?
No, he was Durham Light Infantry through and through. We had Education Corps sergeants, but he was Durham Light Infantry, definitely.
In what little leisure time you had, what did you do?
Well, we played quite a bit of sport in cricket, rugby, and nine times out of ten, the opposition in cricket and rugby were officers or professional sportsmen who had been called up and retained at the 4th IDC as physical training instructors. Football was different. There was quite a galaxy of footballers available, even from the recruits and everybody. One of the things which the army took pride of place on was hockey. And the majority of the bandsmen, as you can appreciate, who were pre-war soldiers and had been out in India and China and the Sudan and that, were brilliant hockey players. And of course, they taught us all the tricks of the trade of playing hockey, which you wouldn't have had unless you went to a public school. Cross-country running was another sport that we had to indulge in. And if you didn't come in within a certain number of places from the front, you did the same exercise again in your own time, which meant you weren't fit. And therefore, you had to go around the course again. Paper chasers was another thing that we did in sport. And of course, included in our sports program was the gymnasium. And there you had people like Billy Nicholson, who was an international footballer, a chap called Freddie Lishman, who played for Sunderland. There was various people called Taylor and Johnson, who played for Newcastle. And there was international goalkeeper from the Duke of Wellington Regiment, and there was people that played rugby for Wales. And of course we went in and we did forward rolls, backward rolls, we did the horse, we learned to climb the rope very proficiently, and did general physical exercises, but in a different way to what the recruits did. The recruits, more or less, it was a punishment to them because they had to carry these great logs around with them and raise them above their heads in this kind of thing, where we went in and everything was explained to us. And of course, we were at that young age, I suppose, our bodies were still developing, so they knew what kind of exercises were required to develop our bodies in the right way that it was done. Where the recruits came in, and they were just being toughened up and went through forced marches and this kind of thing. I think it was 10 mile that they do with full equipment on in 2 hours, which takes some doing when you're carrying 70 pound in kit.
Did you play games against civilian sides in the neighbourhood?
Oh yes, well we played against the local mines people, the pits and everything. We played against local schools and that. I remember we played against some evacuees from Gateshead called the Blue Coats School, because there was a lot of evacuees brought down from the Tyne into the area, and that we played against those people. And of course the people in question, the older, the adults, of course they went as guest players to these people. And I mean, you get a place like Spennymoor, who would invite Billy Nicholson to go along as a guest player, and you couldn't get in the ground.